Welcome back to the deep dive. There's this idea out there right now, and it feels like it's everywhere.
It's very powerful.
It is. The idea that, the decades-long push for civil rights, for DEI, that it's all just gone too far.
The classic pendulum has swung too far argument.
Exactly. And that this has created a new unfair system, one that's tilted against groups that have historically been dominant. So, white men primarily.
And this is where that term, that label, reverse discrimination, gets thrown around. It's presented not just as a feeling, but as a political reality, a way to reframe accountability as well as a new kind of oppression.
And that reframing is everything, isn't it? We've brought a pretty deep stack of sources today to really dig into this, including some great legal analysis from Eric Sanders.
Right.
And he argues that reverse discrimination is, well, it's a political label. It's not something you'll actually find in federal civil rights law, specifically in Title VII.
So our mission for this deep dive is to really put that claim of systemic disadvantage to the test.
And we're going to test it against the hardest evidence we can find. First, the actual legal text of the Civil Rights Act.
Then the hard enforcement data from the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for 2024.
And finally, the really detailed labor market numbers from the 2023 Bureau of Labor Statistics.
So we have the law, the enforcement, and the economic reality.
Our sources frame the core conflict here so well. The question is, why does accountability feel like bias? Why does equality feel like an injury?
Well, it all starts with a baseline assumption. It's an assumption that a lot of critics of civil rights enforcement hold, maybe without even realizing it.
And what's that?
They assume that the way things were before any intervention, that the status quo was neutral, that it was merit-based and fundamentally fair.
So if a company's leadership was, say, 95% white and 90% male, the assumption is that's just meritocracy at work.
Exactly. Not the result of any structural bias or, informal networks.
It's just
the best people rose to the top.
And if you start from that premise, then what happens when you try to change it?
Well, that's the critical part. When a regulatory intervention comes in, whether it's a pay audit or standardized interview questions, and it alters those outcomes, then that oversight is treated as favoritism. It's seen as a distortion of the natural merit-based order.
So accountability gets reframed as bias.
Right. And for people who are used to that old system, that insulated system, the shift toward equality literally feels like a loss. It feels like an injury.
And that's the whole idea that the law, starting with Title VII, just flatly rejects.
It does. Title VII doesn't care about historical norms. It only cares if your employment decisions are based on lawful criteria. Race, sex, religion, those are off the table.
So the law itself doesn't even recognize a forward or reverse direction of discrimination?
No.
Okay, let's unpack that. Let's start with the legal bedrock.
We have to.
The intent of Title VII. This goes all the way back to 1964.
Right. And the text, the foundational text from the Civil Rights Act, is remarkably clear. It prohibits employers from discriminating against any individual.
Any individual.
Any individual.
Right.
With respect to their pay, their job conditions, anything, because of that person's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin.
We should probably linger on that phrase, any individual. It doesn't say any historically marginalized individual.
No, it doesn't. And that's the whole key. That's the legal point that just dismantles the entire premise of a reverse discrimination debate.
How so?
The statute doesn't rank protected classes. It doesn't say, one group gets more protection than another. There's no hierarchy. And crucially, it doesn't recognize a direction. There's no forward or reverse.
There's just discrimination or not.
There is only compliance with the statute or violation of the statute, period.
So this means a white person, a white man, has been fully and equally protected by this law since the day it was signed in 1964.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's never a time when the law didn't apply to them. Their claims have always been judged by the exact same legal frameworks as everyone else's.
So the whole narrative that the law somehow flipped or changed its priorities is...
It's just not compatible with the plain text of the law.
Yeah.
A law that's been on the books for 60 years.
And our sources really emphasize that this design, this neutrality, was intentional. Congress knew that discrimination wasn't just, a few bad apples.
Exactly. They knew it was structural.
Yeah.
It was baked into the system. How companies hired, who they promoted, the informal old boys networks.
So the law was designed to disrupt those systems.
It was designed to disrupt the distribution of opportunity, but only where that distribution was being produced by unlawful criteria. It wasn't a promise to keep corporate hierarchies the same. It was a promise of legality.
And that gets right to the heart of the resistance then and now. The real target was discretion.
Oh, absolutely. If you go back and read the legislative history, The critics in 1964 were terrified about losing their discretion.
Their ability to make common sense judgments.
That's the exact language they used. Common sense judgments about who was the right fit or who fit the culture.
Which was really just code for people who look and think like us.
It was the gatekeeping mechanism.
Yeah.
And the supporters of Title VII knew that. So the law didn't abolish discretion, not at all.
Yeah.
It just did something much more profound.
What's that?
It subjected discretion to the rule of law.
Okay, break that down. What does that mean in practice?
It means if your discretionary choice, your gut feeling about a candidate, produces a racially biased outcome, you, the employer, now have to legally justify that choice as a business necessity. Your gut feeling is no longer enough.
And that distinction between unconstrained discretion and lawful discretion, that seems to be where the entire modern reverse discrimination argument lives.
It is. The backlash collapses those two ideas. It argues that any limit on a manager's total unconstrained discretion is an attack on merit itself.
So when an enforcement action disrupts the outcomes of that old subjective system,
the disruption itself is treated as the bias. It's a way to avoid asking the harder question, which is, hey, was our discretionary system actually operating unlawfully this whole time?
And then the tools used to enforce the law, like audits or standardized reviews, they get painted as ideological.
It's a brilliant rhetorical move. The moment you require a company to explain its decisions, to make them legible and fair, that's precisely when you start hearing claims of reverse discrimination.
So the claim itself is a sign that enforcement is actually starting to work on a systemic level.
In a very real sense, yes.
We have to talk about a specific Supreme Court case that gets brought up constantly to support this backlash narrative. The decision in Ames versus the Ohio Department of Youth Services.
Yes. This is a crucial one to get right, because the public narrative is so different from the legal reality.
People cite Ames as this huge win for reverse discrimination claimants.
They do. But when you actually read the unanimous decision, it was an incredibly narrow technical clarification. It was, as our source puts it, statutory housekeeping.
Okay, so what was the mess it was cleaning up? What was the problem?
For years, some of the lower federal courts, like the Sixth Circuit, had created a special extra rule that only applied to majority group plaintiffs.
So only to white or male plaintiffs?
Correct. And this rule put a heightened evidentiary burden on them, an extra hurdle they had to clear right at the start of their case.
What did they have to prove?
They had to show what the court called background circumstances, which would suggest that their employer was this weird, unusual place that actually discriminated against the majority.
Wow. So the court was basically saying, we assume companies don't discriminate against white people, so you have to prove your company is an exception before we'll even really hear your case.
That's a perfect summary. It was a social assumption baked right into the legal standard. And it's completely at odds with the neutrality of Title VII.
Which is why the Supreme Court stepped in.
Exactly. And they were unanimous. They said this background circumstances test has no basis in the text of the law. The statute protects individuals, and courts are not allowed to add extra burdens based on who they think is more or less likely to face bias.
So if I'm a white man claiming racial discrimination, I now face the exact same legal standard as a black woman claiming the same thing. No special hurdles for me.
That is the ultimate outcome of Ames. It restored the symmetry of the statute. It said the same basic evidentiary framework for proving intentional discrimination applies to everyone. It was about due process, not a revolution.
So why do critics wave it around as a victory for the idea of reverse discrimination?
Because the concept is political, not legal.
Yeah.
They needed the perception that the law was biased against them to be removed. By striking down that procedural hurdle, the court confirmed the courthouse doors are open to everyone equally.
So just to be crystal clear, Ames did not lower the bar for what a white plaintiff ultimately has to prove?
Not one bit.
And it did not recognize reverse discrimination as some special category of legal harm.
Absolutely not. It just took the lower court's sociological guesswork out of the process. For any claimant, from any group, the burden is still incredibly high.
Yeah.
You have to prove that unlawful bias was the real reason for what happened to you. Ames didn't make that any easier.
Okay. So if the law itself doesn't support this narrative, the proof has to be in the numbers. Let's shift gears and open the evidence locker. The labor market data.
Right. If there were real systemic disadvantage facing white men, it wouldn't be able to hide. You'd see it clearly.
Where would we see it?
In earnings, in unemployment rates, in who gets access to certain jobs, and in who gets promoted. And for that, we're turning to the 2023 Bureau of Labor Statistics data. It's the gold standard.
And the hypothesis we're testing is that there's been a structural reversal, that white men have actually fallen behind.
And the data just does not support that conclusion. Across almost every key metric of economic power and stability, white men remain structurally insulated, especially relative to Black and Hispanic workers.
But we have to tackle the big counterexample, the one that gets used all the time to argue the hierarchy has flipped, the agent earnings counterexample.
We have to. And we have to be precise with the numbers. If you look at the median weekly earnings for full-time workers in 2023, white men earned $1,225.
Okay.
They are not the top earning group.
Right. The data shows Asian men have the highest median weekly earnings at $1,635.
Significantly higher.
Okay, let me stop you there because this is the point everyone jumps on, isn't it? If white men are no longer number one on earnings and Asian men are earning over $400 more a week, doesn't that prove that the hierarchy has been disrupted? Doesn't that show a real disadvantage, at least relative to one group?
That is a very important challenge, and it's why looking at that one aggregate number can be so misleading.
Right.
The reason for that earnings gap is not preferential treatment or systemic bias against white workers. It's overwhelmingly driven by something else.
Which is?
Occupational and educational concentration.
Okay, unpack that. The difference between high pay and high power.
Exactly. The data shows that 59% of Asian workers are in management, professional, and related fields. For white workers, it's 44%. But if you drill down into very specific high-paying fields, the numbers are even more stark.
Like in tech.
Tech and medicine. Asian workers make up 36% of all software developers, 21% of all pharmacists. These are highly technical, merit-intensive jobs that pay extremely well, but they are not necessarily the roles that confer broad institutional power.
So you can have a high salary without having your hand on the levers of corporate control strategy, hiring, capital.
Precisely. This is what's often called the bamboo ceiling. You see high representation in technical and professional ranks, but that doesn't translate into a proportional share of executive leadership or seats on the board. The Asian earnings data actually disproves the zero-sum reverse discrimination idea.
Oh.
It shows that it's possible for another demographic to achieve high earnings through educational and occupational choices without systemically displacing the dominant group from the real command posts of the economy.
That makes sense. So let's look at those command posts, the command post reality, as you call it. This is where we see who's really in charge.
This is where the structural insulation becomes undeniable.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at the roles that control capital, that manage labor, that oversee massive operational risk.
So what do the numbers say? Who is sitting in those seats?
The BLS data shows a continuing, profound overrepresentation of white workers. Let's take construction managers. They oversee huge projects, huge budgets. 90% are white.
90%?
Or aircraft pilots and flight engineers. Ultimate responsibility for SASE, for massive assets, 92% white.
Okay.
And maybe the most telling when it comes to control over land and primary capital. Farmers, ranchers, and other agricultural managers, 96% white.
96%. Those are not the statistics of a group facing systemic displacement. That is the definition of entrenchment.
It is the ultimate proof. You see diversification in some technical fields, which is where the high Asian earnings come from, but you see no inversion, not even significant convergence, in the core decision-making roles. The pipeline to institutional power remains overwhelmingly homogenous.
So if the top of the hierarchy hasn't flipped, let's look at the other end. Let's use unemployment data to see who is most insulated from economic shocks.
Unemployment data is a great measure for that.
Uh-huh.
If a group is disadvantaged, they're usually the first to be let go in a downturn and the last to be rehired.
So what were the rates in 2023 for men?
The unemployment rate for white men, 20 and over, was 3.1%.
And for comparison?
For black men, it was 5.3%. For Hispanic men, 4.3%. Again, if the reverse discrimination claim were true, you'd expect the white male unemployment rate to be significantly higher, not lower.
And it's not just about whether you lose your job, but how long it takes to find a new one.
Exactly. The median duration of unemployment. For white workers, it was 8.4 weeks. For black workers, it was 10.3 weeks. That's a structural cushion. When white workers lose their jobs, on average, they get back on their feet faster.
But our source material really hones in on what it calls the most persistent economic penalty in the entire workforce, the one faced by Black women.
This is maybe the single most powerful piece of data to refute the overcorrection thesis. If the system had truly swung too far, you'd expect the groups at the very bottom of the historical hierarchy to be catching up.
And they're not.
They are not. The penalty persists relentlessly.
Let's break down the metrics, starting with the pay gap.
In 2023, the median weekly earnings for Black women were $889.
And for white men, it was $1,225.
Right. So Black women are earning about 73 cents on the white male dollar for full-time work. This isn't a blip. It's a structural feature of our economy.
And what about the argument that this is about, you know, lower participation in the workforce?
The data completely contradicts that. Black women participate at very high rates, often out of necessity. If you look at mothers with children under 18, 79.5% of Black mothers are in the labor force. That's higher than white mothers. It's 73.5%.
So you have this dynamic of high attachment to the workforce.
Paired with high risk. The unemployment rate for Black women was 4.9% compared to just 2.8% for white women.
So that's the real signature of disadvantage. You have to work, but you face a higher risk of joblessness, and you get paid significantly less when you do have a job.
And their occupational distribution confirms it. Only 42% of Black women are in those higher-paying management and professional roles compared to 49% of white women. The data just offers zero empirical support for the idea that systemic disadvantage has somehow shifted to white men.
Okay, so the claim fails legally because the statute is neutral. It fails empirically because the labor data shows the exact opposite. So let's turn to our third and final piece of evidence, the retaliation crisis. This comes from the 2024 EEOC enforcement data.
Right, and this tells us what the actual fights on the ground are about, where the real conflict in the workplace is happening today.
The logic of the backlash narrative would be that if enforcement had gone too far, companies would be so compliant, so terrified of lawsuits, that the number of complaints would be going down.
Demand for enforcement should be falling, exactly.
But that's not what's happening.
Not at all. In fiscal year 2024, the EEOC received 88,531 new charges of discrimination.
Wow!
That's a 9% increase over the previous year. So the conflict is not receding. The demand for intervention is growing.
That one number really undermines the whole idea of an overcorrected system. But the most telling statistic, the one that really gives us a window into the modern workplace, is the dominant fact pattern. Let's focus on that. What are the numbers?
Retaliation is the single most common allegation filed with the EEOC. It appeared in 42,301 cases last year.
Which is what percentage of the total?
An incredible 47.8%.
Wait, so almost half, one out of every two discrimination charges filed in America includes a claim of retaliation.
Yes. And this isn't a new blip. It's a massive trend. Back in 1997, retaliation was in less than 20% of charges. The rise to nearly 50% is the defining story of modern civil rights enforcement.
What does that tell us? It means the most common story isn't about not getting hired. It's about what happens after you complain.
Exactly. It's what happens after an employee tries to exercise their legal rights. And this dynamic just completely contradicts the backlash narrative. A world defined by reverse discrimination against white men would not have a docket dominated by retaliation. Because retaliation is the signature of institutional defensiveness. It thrives in places that treat accountability as provocation. It's a sign of resistance to the law, not overcorrection by the law.
And this is where that theme of image control versus actual operations really hits home.
It's the perfect lens.
Companies can have a great public-facing image, all the right DEI statements. That's the image control.
But the retaliation data shows us their actual operations. It shows that when an employee internally raises a flag about bias, the system's first instinct is often to punish the messenger.
And we should quickly run through the other main types of claims, just for perspective.
Right. It's not like these are the only issues. Disability claims are in 38% of charges. Race is in about 31%. And Mary Zach's in about 29%. These are the persistent core harms.
And these aren't just frivolous complaints. The EEOC has a very high success rate when it takes a case to court.
An incredibly high success rate. They recovered over $469 million for victims last year. And they have a 97% success rate in resolving lawsuits on the merits. That is proof that enforcement is following provable violations.
So the data tells a story of deep systemic problems still being met with intense institutional resistance.
The main conflict is resistance to accountability, not a system that's gone too far.
Which brings us to our final point, the great irony of all this. The push to dismantle DEI is framed as a return to neutrality, but our sources argue it's really about risk migration.
And to get this, we have to quickly break down the legal idea that the backlash is really truly afraid of, even if they never say its name, disparate impact.
Right. Let's explain this in simple terms. It's about looking at the outcome of the system, not just the heart of the boss.
That's the best way to put it. The disparate impact doctrine says you don't need a villain with malicious intent to have an illegal system. You can have a policy that looks totally neutral on its face.
Like requiring a certain kind of degree or relying only on a manager's subjective recommendation for promotions.
Exactly. And that neutral-looking rule might still be unlawful.
Yeah.
If it disproportionately screens out a protected group, say, women or black applicants, and the employer can't prove that the rule is actually necessary for the business, then it's illegal. It shifts the burden from finding a bad guy to fixing a bad system.
And that's why it's so threatening to the status quo. It forces a company to ask, why are all our executives from the same background? What part of our process is producing this result?
And they have to be able to defend that process with data,
right,
with business necessity. Good intentions are no longer a legal defense.
Which leads us directly to why most DEI initiatives were created in the first place.
They weren't born from ideology. Things like pay audits, structured interviews, widening the recruitment pool, these were adopted as direct liability responses to Title VII law.
They're risk management tools.
Pure and simple. They are the infrastructure you build to make sure you can defend your decisions in court, or even better, to avoid court altogether by fixing the problems proactively.
And that reveals the final irony. When a company gets rid of this infrastructure to satisfy political pressure, they're not returning to neutrality.
No. They are reverting to the single most legally dangerous system you can have.
Mm-hmm.
Unregulated discretion. The very habitat where bias and discrimination thrive and are hardest to see.
So getting rid of a pay audit doesn't make pay disparities go away. It just ensures you won't find out about them until you're hit with a massive class action lawsuit.
The legal risk doesn't vanish. It just goes underground. It migrates. The company is choosing to shift its exposure from small, proactive compliance costs to potentially catastrophic, reactive litigation costs.
That $469 million the EEOC recovered is a pretty stark reminder of those costs. Getting rid of your early warning system for lawsuits seems like a very strange business decision.
Our source puts it perfectly. Equality under the law is a statutory command. It's a condition of doing business. It's not a cultural preference you can opt out of when it becomes politically inconvenient.
So let's bring it all together for you. The claim of systemic reverse discrimination just doesn't hold up.
It fails on every axis.
It's not in the statute. It's contradicted by the labor data, which shows continued advantage at the top and severe penalty at the bottom.
And it's contradicted by the effacement data, where the real story is institutional resistance in the form of retaliation.
The discomfort people might feel when a system they're used to changes, that feeling might be real. But according to the law and the data, it's not a legally recognized injury.
It is, quite simply, the friction that occurs when unregulated power is finally subjected to the constraint of law.
And that brings us to our final provocative thought for you to think about after this deep dive is over.
We've established that the backlash against all of this says its goal is to restore true merit and neutrality.
But there's a profound conflict in that position. If the goal is truly merit, the objective measurement of someone's skill and ability, why does the primary tactic involve dismantling the very systems, like structured interviews and pay audits, that were specifically designed to help you measure merit objectively and screen out the subjective bias that always clouds it?
The attempt to restore merit by getting rid of the tools that measure it.
It really makes you wonder what the true goal is. That's something worth thinking about.